Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Summer is all about the freedom to have fun. Forget a vacation and take a tequila-cation with new Truly Tequila Soda. This refreshing blend of real fruit juice from concentrate, sparkling water, and premium tequila blanco is the drink of the summer. Try all four refreshing flavors, all with 5% ABV and just 100 calories. Truly Tequila Soda. Keep it light. Hard Seltzer Beverage Company, Boston, Massachusetts. Please drink responsibly.
It's a Friday edition here on Zero Block 30, and today we have five rounds of the magazine. Round number one, old Mad Dog General Mattis is back on the scene with his knife hand held high, but he's here to reenlist a fellow Marine. If you could pick anyone in the world, alive or dead, who you could choose to perform your ceremony, who would it be? We're going to talk about that in round number one. Round number two, the Air Force awarded a $13.3 billion contract to Northrop Grumman for nukes this week, and Kate has a radical radioactive science quiz for us. Ooh, I'm excited about that one. $13.3 billion. It seems like every week we're like, somebody got a new $500 billion contract.
They're just making up numbers at this point. It's all just made up.
Get out of my face, Navy. Stop. The Air Force and the Navy always need money. Marines and Army are like, just give us a couple Band-Aids and a sack full of Motrin and we'll be fine.
Exactly.
Not those other ones. All right, round three. When I say Navy, you say nerds. Navy?
Nerds!
Navy?
Nerds!
That's right. They're fighting the war on CBD and your lotions and hair care products now. And it's not just the Navy. It's my beloved Marine Corps that's acting like a bunch of pussies about CBD, too. And round number four. Over to Australia, where we tell you about the Great Emu War, in which some large flightless birds unwittingly foiled the Australian Army.
A little history for you there, mate.
Oh.
Righto.
And people who aren't familiar with emus, they get confused with ostriches. They're like little ostriches. And before I tell you what round number five is, I have a quick caveat. In my neighborhood, there used to be, when we moved in, the neighborhood abuts a nice little nunnery where retired nuns can go and they live out their final days, and it's a beautiful piece of property, and they have farming stuff there that they can just hang out, because nuns, they, I guess they got to retire too, but where do you go? Like, if you've been working for your church the whole life. Well, there was this emu, and because he lived at the nunnery, we named him King Jesus. And it was an emu named King Jesus. Somebody heard us call him King Jesus, got offended. We changed his name to Kevin. I thought Kevin was dead for like 5 years. I was riding my little scooter, doing some scoot goofing, went up to the nunnery gate. Wouldn't you know it, fucking Kevin was hanging out, just chilling, just living life on the nunnery too. He's retired there, so shout out to longtime Thule Kevin, who's at the nunnery here in
Maybe
San Antonio.
King Jesus was gone, but he rose again because he knew you were coming through on the scooter.
And we my family was so weird, we developed this whole backstory for why King Jesus, also known as Kevin, was there. And it's because he was a retired ballerina, got tired of doing ballerina stuff for the church where he's making all kinds of money for the orphan. Just such a good guy, that Kevin. Unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And finally, round number five, and kind of a 9/11 tradition here on the show, we're going to bring back Large's interview that he told, his unbelievably heartbreaking account of what happened to his family on 9/11. And we're going to do that after the save round, so make sure you stick around for that. And all of that is going to be brought to you by our friends at BarkBox. BarkBox, now, if you've listened to the show for a long period of time, you know that I'm a dog handler and that I have very kind of strict rules for my dog whenever they're young and as they get a little bit older in the house. Like, no getting up on any of the furniture. They're not allowed to bite or chew on anything in the house. I guess that's the only aspect of my life where I'm still like Staff Sergeant Cawthron. Like, it's that. But because Gus is getting older, I can see his hips are like starting to go down a little bit. He's getting more gray on his mask. I have relented some. So Friday nights, he's allowed to get in mega chair with us when and hang out and watch a movie on Friday nights. And I've recently let him try some of the toys from the Super Chewer box. Loves it. They look like weed, and he's so cute walking around with a little joint in his mouth, or like it looks like the buds of a flower from there. He looks so adorable. I feel bad that I haven't let him have toys.
And I have to say, I'm sorry, you were so snobby in your email with the person who sent It was like, I'm sending these toys over. And you were like, thanks. Just a heads up, though. My dog won't chew it because I've trained him not to. So, And then who do I see chewing on the toy?
I had to talk him into it for like 15 minutes. I was like, it's okay. Put it in your mouth, Gus. And then when he finally did, like Kate says, he was wagging his tail all over the place.
Yep.
He was so damn happy. If you want to make your big puppy boy happy too, just like my Gussie Tussie, you can do that by going to superchewer.com/ZBT and get a free weed-themed toy in your first box when you sign up. That's superchewer.com/ZBT for free 420-themed toy in your first box when you can sign up. These went fast whenever they did this in April, so make sure you go get it now. Also, they have another one that had steak and all kinds of shit in it. And I'm going to see if Gus wants to chew on the steak while I'm over by the grill this weekend. I think that would be a lovely little time. Make sure you go to superchewer.com/ZBT for 25% off. You're going to have a great deal, and your puppy's going to love it too, because unboxing it with your dog, I mean, there's nothing better.
It's a treat.
Nothing better at all. I feel like every time you turn on – oh, I guess I don't turn on the TV. I guess every time you turn on Twitter or Instagram, you're seeing something crazy. This Bob Woodward guy, how in the world did he secure 18 interviews with the president?
He's done it on name alone. I guess
whenever you're part with it. But if you're the president, there's only two people that I don't think I would ever want to talk to. Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward.
Yeah, seriously.
Because the last
Woodward
time,
and Bernstein, get the step in. Get out of here.
No way. If I'm the chief of staff, I'm like, absolutely not. No, you're not talking to him. 18 times? Dude, if anybody asks to talk to me 18 times, my automatic reaction is absolutely not. Yeah. There is nobody I would sit down with 18 times. What could you possibly be speaking about for 18 times?
Unless you're trying to build a case against someone.
The only thing I can think is that Bob Woodward has written so many books about other presidents, Bush and Obama and Clinton and all these Nixon. Other presidents and Nixon. but maybe all I can think is that Trump also wants to be
talked about.
It's an ego thing, maybe. I don't know.
Absolutely right. Like, if I became super successful, if I did something that outside of the barstool world where I got a bunch of money and did something, and Big Cat and A-Rod didn't come to me and want to interview me for their podcast, I'd be fucking heated. I want to go on that. You want Bob Woodward to cover you. But you also got to know, there's some things you can't say, and it's out on tape.
This guy wrote All the President's Men. I mean, this guy knows his reporting and knows his stuff. So, like, I mean, you're right. I think it's an ego thing. I think he can't help himself. I don't know.
Yeah, it's possible.
I don't know if I'd be able to either.
No, I wouldn't.
I'd be spilling the beans.
You want to write a book about me? Let's go. I'll sit down with you for 18 times. But I think he definitely, it sounds like he should have waited until after his presidency, be it this year or in 4 years. So,
what do you think? It's kind of like when Lieutenant Caffey knows that Jessup wants to say it on the stand.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that he wants to say it. Trump wants to say, yeah, I knew. Of course I knew. You need to remain calm. Nobody freak out.
And for those who don't know what the fuck we're talking about, one of the big news stories is that Bob Woodward he has an interview with Trump where Trump's like, yeah, I knew before it was confirmed that coronavirus was pretty dangerous and bad and I played it down and blah, blah, blah. Not the best. But again,
I feel like
at this point, nothing he says or does will affect him negatively. I feel like he's just got this, with his fans and his supporters, he's got this like invincibility cloak around him where it seems shocking, but is it really? It doesn't really matter, I guess.
I will say this, you know, after the great Zelensky said it, what the American public doesn't know is what makes them the America public. I didn't have a huge problem with him trying to play things down, because if you just told the American public every last detail about everything, that would cause a hysteria. I truly believe that.
Yeah, but I think there's a difference playing it down and being like, oh, it's the same as the common flu. Like,
how
it's not
you
that big of
play
deal.
It down, yes. Therein lies the rub and how you play it down.
You know, you could play it down by being responsible and saying, hey, this is a big deal. It's affecting large parts of the world. We're going to attack it and we're going to do it in a scientific manner. And here's how we're going to do it. Like, if you go out there and lead, people like that. Like, and if he would have taken this and done really, really well, he might have, like, changed some people's minds if you go out there. But I don't know if that's whenever you're really just focused on the economy, and I mean, that's what a lot of people like as well. I don't know what you do, man. Yeah. That's not the way I would have done it, for
no,
sure.
No, it's kind of like what I've said about the Big Ten commissioner and the presidents and those universities with regards to college football. If one of them had just come out earlier in the year and said, hey, here's our plan, here's what we're going to do, here's how we're going to execute it, and that ultimately failed, at least they can say, hey, we put a plan together. The big hubbub around the college football, and I'm going off track a little bit here, is that they seemingly had no plan. So, yeah, I appreciate honesty. I appreciate being forthright. But maybe he should have had more of a plan than to sit down with Bob Woodward and just divulge all this information now.
Fun side note leading us into the next round. Another part of the Bob Woodward book that has come out, Mattis, because Mattis is in our first round. In 2017, when things were super tense with North Korea, apparently tensions were so high that then Defense Secretary James Mattis slept in his regular clothes. He, like, just always was constantly dressed so that at any moment he could hop out of bed and be looking sharp when he had to run in for possible
nuclear
war.
Oh, get out
of
my face, Mattis. How long does it take to get dressed? Oh, what a fucking hardo. Like, you're not in a combat zone. Like, you're not doing that where you have to sleep with one boot on. You're in fucking Washington, D.C., to put on some slippers and go down to the Pentagon. That's ridiculous.
That's not the way the warrior monk rolls, Chapsy.
I mean, he's not going to look good. I would much rather him take 2 minutes, have his stuff hung neatly in his wall locker like Private Santiago did the moment that he was going to be shipped off the base forever. But he didn't do that. He didn't sleep with one shoe on.
Well, he was very well dressed for round number one, where he was raising a knife hand at a Marine, but in a very good way. Mattis, he's 70 years old now, did you know? Mm-hmm. He was on hand at an August 18th deactivation ceremony for a Marine unit at the local National Guard training facility when one Marine corporal, Eduardo Bello Resendez, he decided to leave the Corps after 6 years to reenlist into the Army National Guard. So I didn't know this, but the reservist requires no training for Marines in nearly 70 specialties if you want to switch from Marine to National Guard. Mm-hmm. So he was a reservist part of 4th Tank Battalion, and that unit was recently axed. They're axing all these tank units as part of a plan to go, like, they're reorienting towards other things for future fights with Russia or China, and tanks really aren't part of that anymore. So it was during that deactivation ceremony, where they were chopping the tanks and saying bye, that he learned of the Marine to Guard program. He didn't even know it existed until he's at that ceremony. They're probably scuttlebutting by the water coolers or something like that, by the bubbler. And he hears about this, and he's like, sign me up right now. I'm going to do it right now. So beforehand, the Marines transition counselor approached the retired Marine general. Mattis was there, and he asked if he wanted to administer the oath of enlistment. And Mattis replied that he would be honored as long as it was okay with the Marine. It was indeed okay with the Marine. Corporal Bello Resendez was shocked, excited.
Actually, I don't want Mattis to do it. I want my corporal to do it.
Yeah, actually, my girlfriend's here from college for the weekend, so I was thinking...
My mom had flown in to watch the tanks get taken down. Can they both do it?
Yes. So he was shocked, excited, and almost speechless, but finally managed to respond with, are you serious? He's here? He said he would? And then Sergeant First Class Stephen Vincent said, absolutely, killer. Do you want him to do the oath for you? The response was emphatic. Hell yeah, of course. Again,
and there's
yeah.
also a small white stain that appeared on his trousers.
Yeah, he creamed his
I love that he called him killer, too.
Would you have loved the Sergeant First Class, Stephen Vincent, would you have loved his response if the corporal was like, no, thank you, I'm good? He would have been like,
oh my
devil
God.
Dog, think again, devil dog.
It doesn't matter what
think
you fucking
again,
want.
Think again, killer. Right, exactly. And as we all know, Mattis is a retired four-star general who served 44 years in the Corps before he was President Donald Trump's first Secretary of Defense. He appeared in civilian attire, possibly that he had slept in, though it looked crisp, sunglasses, and a handkerchief around his neck for use of a face mask. That's
any word about that leather jacket?
Yeah, no word about he was not wearing that cool leather jacket he was modeling in a previous episode. But sign of a cool old guy, handkerchief instead of a regular blue mask.
Oh, I disagree. Mm. I disagree big time. Handkerchief in the world of coronavirus is just like a breeding ground. That's a petri dish in your own little pocket.
I don't know.
It always has been. Blowing your nose and sticking that in your pocket? What are we doing?
What
That's like a
doing?
Facial jizz rag that you're having right. in your trousers.
I'd venture to say he's not necessarily using this handkerchief to blow his nose with. It's kind of the way people have been wearing bandanas around their necks and just using that as their face mask.
Well, the bandana around the neck. I've been
wearing neck gaiters lately, and it's been lovely.
Bandana around the neck.
The problem
looks cool.
with neck gaiters is that it has to go over your full head, and some people don't like that, although they are very effective.
If you have a little neck, it's embarrassing. You just look like you're wearing it. Anyways, another cool thing about this story, Mattis's brother was a former member of this unit, the guard story said. Both now live back in their hometown of Richland, Washington. And I didn't even know Mattis had a brother. It's like hard to picture him with family because he seems so
any
like
family whatsoever. I just imagine he's just a single soul roaming this earth all by his lonesome, and without his beloved core, he has nobody.
He keeps a low pro. He keeps a low profile. You know what I mean? So yeah, an interesting story there. Very cool to have Mattis, General Mad Dog Mattis, and you. This kid didn't even know. This corporal didn't even know that he was there. And all of a sudden, he's the one performing his reenlistment. Also, too, crazy move to, in a split-second decision, decide to... He didn't even know about the guard program, the Marine to Guard program. He hears about it and is like, okay, quick, I'll switch. Like,
I like that. Just go out there and do it. You know what you want to do and just act on that. I think Kyle and I are the only ones in the group that actually did reenlist. So we have some hypothetical and some real-life conversation to have. Let's start with you, Kyle. How did you reenlist whenever you did it?
I went into my captain's office, my company commander, and he asked me if I wanted to do a thing, and I said, no, sir, and I signed the paper, and that was it. Like, I didn't.
That's very Kyle move.
I was just going to say, that's so Kyle.
That's so Kyle. That's like so Kyle.
I don't want to deal with all the bullshit. No one wants to watch you reenlist. Like, just sign the paper.
You're absolutely right.
They do not want to.
They do not.
So that was mine.
Chaps, what'd you do, Chaps?
Well, I went and signed mine when I was in New York. They brought it up and faxed it to me when I was in New York and signed it and sent it in because I wanted to get that bonus while I was doing Secret Service stuff. And we had a multiple of 5, I think it was, bonus at the time, which comes out to whenever you're not deployed, like $32,000. And then after taxes, you end up getting like $23,000, $24,000. And I was struggling financially because I was a single dad and living in Northern Virginia, having to pay all those crazy bills and do like child support and all that stuff. I woke up one night after a heavy night of partying and ended up at the Hustlers Club and doing all kinds of shit. And I was like, how much money did I spend? You know, you have those nights out where you wake up and you could still smell like tequila. And you can feel it in your mouth still. Mm. And you're like, how many shots did I buy? Did I buy a lot of people? If you're like Kate that ends up buying shots for everybody whenever you're out. I checked my bank account and I had $25,000 more than I did whenever I went to New York. And I was like, what a night.
What a rush. Yeah.
What a rush.
Yeah. See, so no fancy pants ceremonies needed for either of you. Just quiet. And, you know, every year there's that, like, remember that there's like the photos of the people, the Navy sailors standing in the ocean reenlisting and the whole unit swearing the rubber duck tubes around their waist. And like, what was the other real, like, everyone was mad at this woman for like doing something silly during hers. And it's like,
oh no, that was a retirement ceremony. I recently saw that video come across again. It was a Navy senior chief who retired and she danced walking like, up, which you're
you
getting
do,
out.
You
did 20 years.
Who gives
if
a
shit? If you want to fucking do the WAP dance, I don't care. Like,
exactly.
Do whatever you need to.
120,000,000%. If I did reenlist, if I had made the decision to reenlist, it would never was a thought that crossed my mind for 1 second, though. Mm-hmm. But if it had been, love the Marine Corps, really
right.
do. Mm. Yes, but I would have, because I said alive or dead in my scenario, I could have someone come back to do it for me. And once again, I'm bringing up my girl Joan Rivers. I'm bringing her back from the dead. Everybody has to come to the ceremony in their civvies. And then she, because she's a fashion, she's like a roast, queen of roasting and a queen of fashion. She goes through the ranks like a sergeant doing an inspection. And she just roasts the shit out of everyone's civilian clothes. And I get to like stand next to her and join in. Because remember, isn't it for like a few minutes in between you're not in the military anymore, between your reenlistment? Right.
Okay.
So I would have that freedom. I would have like a good 5 minutes to go through and just Festivus everybody's ass and roast their fits and all that stuff. And then she would re-enlist me and I would be good. Can a civilian re-enlist somebody?
Yeah. I mean, you can basically have any, there has to be somebody there that can do it, like that can sign off on it. But it's essentially like being a reverend, where as long as you have somebody that can sign it, anybody can do it. What about reading your citation? If you're there whenever reading the oath of enlistment and you have like an official narrator, who would you pick for that? Just a Morgan voice Freeman. That would stick out to people.
Morgan Freeman.
Oh. No, I'd go Liev Schreiber.
Who?
Liev Schreiber, the guy who does Hard Knocks.
Oh, yeah.
Ah, okay.
I would have Bobcat Goldthwait.
there you go.
That's perfect for you. That's perfect.
What are you doing at your re-enlistment? Oh, this is a perfect charcuterie board.
Well, actually, I wouldn't re-enlist. I would just, this would probably, the equivalent would be a promotion ceremony, and I was thinking about it. Mm. You know who I would have if I could, if since you're doing Joan Rivers and she's dead, I would have General Norman Schwarzkopf, because I think I've told this before on the show.
You know, you're doing Joan Rivers. Speaking of, I'm going to do General Norman Schwarzkopf.
Well, here's why. He has a little bit close to my heart. When I graduated and I walked off the stage with my diploma, we have this thing where we have the 50th anniversary class hand you your lieutenant bars, and General Norman Schwarzkopf handed me my second lieutenant bars.
Oh, wow, that's very cool.
So that would be pretty cool to have him for a reenlistment. And speaking of Marines and being a Marine forever and ever, yesterday I was at the golf course and I was walking off the 18th and walking by the putting green, and I saw an older gentleman there wearing a USMC hat. And he was started chatting me up, and we're talking, and I said, "Oh, you're a Marine." And he misheard me, and he said, "No, still a Marine."
Mm. Oh, God.
No, no, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
He already had it ready to go. Yeah. He's one of those. My God. On behalf of Marines everywhere, I apologize for that incident. My goodness. Sheesh.
Why? He's an old guy. He's allowed to do that.
He's allowed to be proud.
I'm shaming olds now too. I'm off the cuff.
He's allowed. I'm just doing that shit. I did that yesterday. Somebody reached out to have somebody come on for an interview, and they said he's an ex-Marine. I was like, absolutely not, pal. Now he can't come on the show. Sorry.
I love giving older Marines the nod in the city, though. If I see their little hats on, I give them the nod. It's like the Jeep wave.
I was at Lackland earlier this week picking up some medicine. And there was a dude there that was wearing, he was skinny as the day is long, an older guy, probably like 70-ish, wearing a Vietnam era hat. And he had on this leather vest that had like all these different unit passages from Vietnam on. He had this cane that had like a shiny skull on top. Black dude that rode in on a motorcycle, and you could just see that this dude was the epitome of like a crusty old veteran. I love that guy. I wanted to just sit down and be like, you know what, let's just go out to the old E Club, me and you, we're gonna put a couple back right now, just a couple PBRs with the boys. That's all we're gonna do right now. I want to be that guy. I'm gonna be the red-haired guy on the putting green, just chilling and having a red hat and correcting Khan's ass whenever he comes by.
Speaking of, to circle it back around to Mattis, I heard, so he like lives in Washington State in some boonies area, I guess, on the river. And I heard every now and then you look out in the river and locals see him fly fishing out there. Do you think if I were to get fly fishing gear and act real cool and I'm waiting in the river all the time, and then one day there he is and I'm like, oh, sir, fellow devil dog, Marine, Leatherneck, hello.
He'd be more impressed if you said General, because that's the custom courtesy. They don't like
General. I would also say, hey there, killer, hey, devil dog. But I'm like, hey, I have a couple Crispy Boys. I have a couple Rainier beers in my cooler. You want to crack a Crispy Boy with me? I think he would.
Oh, yeah.
I think he only drinks whiskey at this point. He strikes me as somebody who only drinks whiskey.
I think he'd pretend, I think he'd crack one open with me and stand in the river. And so I'm planning on next summer taking a couple weeks.
And I believe he's on record of being a gin and tonic guy, too.
He
likes to drink. All right, let's move on to round number two, where we're going to talk about a little bit of nukes. But before we do that, one more thing about Mattis. There's no chance he doesn't make his own lures. He is definitely a make
He makes
own
his own
guy.
Fishing lures. Absolutely. Yeah. Hands down. And quick for round two, chaps, I had to surprise you. Explain to us, Barney style, how nukes work.
Okay, nuclear so a nuclear bombs. Device works by you take this little bit of plutonium, right? and you smash it all together. And then you have some uranium. Mix that together. And that's what they call nuclear cake, is what they call that, because you're basically baking.
That's the official name, nuclear cake. Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you – it's yellow cake uranium. And then it spins around real fast, and they find just one atom. They put this one atom into a little – almost like a water balloon that's made out of metal. They put that into a plane, and then they hypothetically drop it somewhere, and it causes a big explosion.
That is correct. Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you for explaining nukes to everyone before we get into this story.
Thank you, Chaps Nye.
Yes, Chaps. Yeah, Chaps Nye, the science guy. Chaps. Anyways, you guys want me to tell this one too?
Yeah, please.
No, I'll do it. So the Air Force on Tuesday awarded a $13.3 billion contract for an engineering and developing work on a replacement of the Minuteman III missile, not associated with KFC Barstool, which has operated continuously for a half a century as a key part of the nuclear force. Critics call the replacement project wasteful and dangerous. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden has not said whether he would, if he was elected in November, support the project known as Ground-Based Strategic Deterrent and through its bipartisan support in Congress. The announcement came just one day after President Donald Trump assailed Pentagon leaders as eager to fight wars and generate profits for defense contractors at a time he has lamented the enormous cost of maintaining a big nuclear arsenal, but his defense budget have supported nuclear modernization. The award of the contract is a big step in a project that is estimated to cost at least $85 billion. The Grumman said that the contract covers 8 years of work to be performed in Utah and several other states, $13.3 billion for 8 years. Defense Secretary Esper hailed the Air Force announcement, saying modernization of the nuclear force is a top priority and key to the nation's defense. The total bill is expected to approach $1.2 trillion. General Tim Ray, who commands the Air Force Elements for National Nuclear Force, said that the ICBM will provide needed improvements over the Minuteman III, which first came online in 1970. The missiles are based in the underground silos in North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado, and Nebraska. Critics, however, say that $13.3 billion is too fucking much money. They didn't say that. I did. This is crazy, man. Like, and one thing, that was another Woodward shit, is that this is – Trump started talking about this during the interviews that he had with him and just said that we have a new nuclear weapon system that's coming online. Nobody knows about it. Well, now they do. Like, you can't
– Now they do.
I love that. Like, nobody knows – because if I was in the position of having any top secret – shit I can know, and you give me the caveat I can declassify anything I want to as well. I have that power given to me by my office. Buddy, I'm telling national secrets all over the place.
Absolutely, because I'm like this. I've said this before. I'm excellent at keeping secrets, but I hate keeping secrets. Uh-huh. If I have some special info, I want to tell you.
Yeah. I mean, that's the greatest position to be in as a president. You know all this stuff. You can have the loose lips all you want to. President Trump goes out to a bar, he ties a couple on, has too many whiskeys and cokes, and starts tweeting out about nuclear shit. Nothing can happen to him because he has the ability to declassify anything he wants to.
I think that's the only reason he doesn't drink. Otherwise, he'd be on Twitter all night.
Can you imagine a drunk Trump on Twitter?
Well, pretty much the same, I guess. But
you know what I want to imagine? A drunk Trump texting people he's fired, like, "Hey, man. Really sorry. You know I love you." And getting into his feelings.
Oh, I don't think so.
Late at night.
I think he's doing fuck you text everybody.
Yeah, I think it would be more along the lines of fuck you text. But I felt very torn reading this article because I'm like, $13.3 billion for this 8 years of work on a new nuclear bomb? Like, that's insane, especially considering everything else the country has going on right now. But also at the same time, hearing we've been using the same one since like 1970 – also didn't make
me
feel so great.
I understand that. And when I was reading it first, I agree with you. But think about things that were made in the 60s and 70s, much higher quality than that is built now. You know that they're not using some thin-ass steel for that. They're using thick boys. Mm-hmm. Think about the washer machine. Now, if you get a Samsung washer machine, you have to replace that motherfucker in 2 years because it's plastic parts on the inside. A 1970s washer machine from Maytag, who I assume made the nukes too, that
for
ain't breaking
sure.
down. That's going to run forever.
That's great.
That's like an old fucking point. Ford F-100.
Yeah. Right. The Minuteman 3 is like a sturdy old Cadillac. We don't really need a new one. We've got, right. Okay, that's a good point.
Minuteman 3 is the Buick of nuclear arsenal.
That is a good point.
I say this in jest, but these numbers just are fake, and the Fed's just going to keep printing money, so I don't really get perturbed by these prices. And I honestly, that you could say $13 billion, you could say $50 billion. It's all sixes and sevens at the end of the day. What does it even matter?
Now, I'm going to come across as an economic expert here, but I recently read an article, and Kyle can probably back me up because he's a Wall Street Journal guy. This, we're approaching the first time in U.S. history where our deficit, our debt, is going to be more than the economy is even worth for the first time in U.S. history. That's pretty scary.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's crazy. But also with the nuclear weapons, I kind of liken it to when you're getting off the bus and you're playing a football game and you're getting off the bus. It helps to look the part. It really, truly does. So the fact that we are building up our nuclear arsenal, kind of like what Kate said, I don't hate it. Like, it's, I don't think it's necessarily 100% the best thing we should be utilizing our money for, but I don't want to be the only guy in the block who doesn't have the best nukes in town.
I will
say,
all
these other countries do have them.
They're talking about these boonies states where we keep the silos, where we keep the current oldie nukes. Have you seen those TV shows where people take the abandoned silos and build
preppers.
And they doomsday preppers? So if I was a doomsday prepper, my ears would be perked up. There's about to be a couple new homes on the market, people.
Well, if they're going to start putting out those Minutemen 3, I might have to open up the Venmo and see if I can get money. Because if I can get my own tactical nuclear weapon, I will become the biggest Second Amendment guy you've ever seen.
For sure.
I'm not interested in having an AR or a fucking Barrett 50 cal or anything like that, or a Ma Deuce. You put a nuclear weapon in my little Dick Skinner's, buddy, I'm having a field day with that thing.
Oh, your neighbor wouldn't know what to do with himself, your asshole neighbor. Right, exactly. I have a little quiz for you guys, since Chaps already knows exactly how a nuclear bomb works. I have a little quiz for you guys. Just beep in. Kyle, you're in on this too, if you think you know. So up first, the first nuclear bomb meant to kill humans. So used in war, not like over at Bikini Atoll, just blowing them up to see what happens. The first nuclear bomb meant to kill humans exploded over what city in what year?
Isn't that World War II, 1945, Hiroshima?
No. Are we talking like in training or it was actually used?
No, meant to actually use. Oh, yeah. Hans has it right. Yeah. It was Hiroshima, Japan, August 6, 1945. 3 days later, a second detonated over Nagasaki. Up next, how many countries have nukes and can you name them?
Oh, I would say, I think it's 23 countries, somewhere around that. And it's going to be Russia. It's us and Russia have a shit ton. Japan. Maybe not Japan. I think Germany got rid of theirs.
United Kingdom, UK.
The UK, Israel.
Pakistan.
France.
Pakistan, India.
France.
India, yeah.
Did you say Russia?
Yeah.
Yeah, we said Russia.
I think it's only
Russia
like nine.
So, no, 8 or 9? There's a couple more, too.
You're missing two big ones, two real big bad guys on our radar here.
Oh, Saudi Arabia.
Did we say
One kept Mattis up at night in his clothes.
Did we say North Korea?
North Korea. Mm. And then you're missing the biggest one of all.
Us?
China.
Oh, China.
We're missing China. It is 9, not 20. Thank God it is not what Chaps thought. 23-something countries don't have it.
I knew it wasn't 20-something.
Nine countries have nuclear weapons that we know about.
They start putting the Minutemen on sale on eBay. They're going to.
9 countries have nukes that we know about. US, UK, Russia, France, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. It's really difficult to be a country that has it without people knowing, right? Because the satellite footprint of what it takes to make nukes.
Yeah, you have like those folks who can look at satellite pictures and determine who's taking a shit. I don't get it, but they can do it.
Right. Okay. Name the 3 parts of an atom as quickly as you can.
The proton, nucleus.
Nope.
Neutron, electron.
Proton, neutron, electron. Okay. But yes, there is a nucleus in there.
They're all in the nucleus.
What is the chemical element metal used in nukes? And what is its symbol on the periodic table?
Plutonium.
Nope.
Uranium.
And you are.
And what's the symbol?
230.
Just
are?
You.
Oh.
You.
It's just you. And it's dense
it's
little metal
you.
Rock. It's just
it's
you.
Just you and me.
And what was the name of the bomb dropped over Nagasaki? Here's a clue. It's
I saw this one. That wasn't nice.
Also, Captain Khan's fat boy. That is my nuclear quiz. I'll be honest. So, Chaps, you were explaining, like, oh, your idea of how nukes work. I have read so many articles.
Wait a minute. That was really dismissive and ugly, Kate, what you just did. The face that you had when you said your idea, that was the most cocky you've been on the show.
But I have tried to read the most broken down articles of how this shit works. And from what I've gathered, in the front of the bomb is like, here's the atoms that are going to be split to fuck shit up. And in the back, there's almost like this gun that when it's at a certain height, it shoots the bullet thing at the other atoms, and that's what splits it and fucks shit up. Like, I have tried and tried and tried again. Thank God they're scientists. So I don't get this shit at all.
I don't think they do either. I think they just were tinkering around in their own little personal shed and they figured it out, because there's no way, you know. Like, I've been doing so much woodworking stuff that I feel like I can figure out a lot of things. You give me a schematic of any sort, I am out. Like, if you say you have to use a schematic to figure this out, not going to happen. This never.
You know what I don't understand? Who was the first dude who thought, one, we got atoms, they're everywhere.
I believe it's Einstein.
And two, something bad will happen if we split that bad boy in half. Well, that's crazy.
In a bomb, is it literally just one tiny little atom in the front of the bomb that the bullet hits? Or is it like you need at least 15 atoms to make a big explosion? Like, how many atoms are we talking about? How much do we need?
And how many Eves, for that matter?
Forget it. God, if you're a nuclear physicist,
that was an all-time dad joke. Well done by me.
Who was that smart group that got mad at us because we thought somebody was dead when they weren't?
Oh.
DARPA.
DARPA, please come on the show and help us.
No, I don't want to talk to those fucking idiots, those nerds.
Okay.
They're going to come on and fact check everything that we said. They're going to be like, oh, yellow cake uranium's not part of it. It is. Mm. I know it is. For a fact.
We're basically, you know, it's much more nuanced, much more detailed. We're basically giving you the Miss Frizzle level of understanding nuclear bombs.
That's right.
Shout to the Magic School Bus.
Right. That's mm-hmm.
Big shout out to the Magic School Bus. Mm-hmm. Also, big shout out to Rocky Boots. Rocky Boots is our go-to boot. I've been wearing them all over the place. They're super comfortable. Even with my skinny little ankles, and I'm wearing them with shorts, I feel good when I'm cruising around Home Depot or Lowe's in them. Rocky Boots, they're built for the man or woman who serves to protect our country. They're designed and built in the U.S. for each individual branch of the military. Most recently, Rocky cited by... got in a contract with the United States Marine Corps that are Barry compliant boots, so you're not going to get lifed out by somebody like Kyle, who doesn't care about a reenlistment bonus. He just wants to sign it and continue to serve. These boots are flash and water resistant, made from 1,000 denier corduroy. What is that?
It's something like a nuke.
Oh, it's extremely durable.
There's
and breathable,
uranium.
So you won't overheat. Mm-hmm. That sounds fancy as shit. Rocky Boots might have made up that word. They might have made it up. Because if you have double, and they do in this ad read, it's double capital letters. So what that means is that it's a proper noun. If you say anything is a proper noun, there's really no arguing it, right?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct.
I agree.
All right. So you can go to rockyboots.com. They are unbelievable boots. In all seriousness, they are great. Make sure you get the t-shirt too, because it's ultra comfortable. Go to rockyboots.com. Enter the promo code ZBT at checkout for 25% off your next pair. People have been sending it like screenshots of the boots that they've been buying. And when Kyle was in, Kate Cons was in, you are going to be paying for boots that are this nice well over $250, $300.
Mm-hmm.
People are getting these starting with a one. That just doesn't happen for military items, and they're comfortable even if you aren't a military member. They have hiking boots. They have all kinds of shit. Just go to their website, rockyboots.com/ZBT. All right, let's get going with round number three. This one has a little bit of CBD goofing involved. Kate, what's going on there?
Can I just say, the CBD thing, it really at least kicked off here in New York City. I want to say when I first moved up here for Barstool like 3 years ago, and I remember walking to work one day and it was like the first shop in the neighborhood. I feel like every town has at least two or three shops now that are like specifically CBD type stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was a coffee shop that had opened up in my neighborhood that was like all CBD everything. And I'm on my way to work. And I think, Chaps, I don't know if you'll remember this. I was like on my way in to do radio or whatever. And I was like, I didn't know quite what CBD was or anything. Like, I didn't do my research. It was so brand new. I was like, I'm going to be real bad, and I'm going to get a fucking CBD coffee on my way into work, and I'm going to see what happens. Like, it was like the first time I smoked a cigarette, and I was like, I'm so fucked up. I'm spinning. Like, 11th grade on the way to a Dave Matthews Band concert.
Whoa.
Anyways, I know. Look at me.
Crash into me.
I know. Certainly. Indeed. But so I drink this coffee and I get to work and I'm like, I think I'm feeling it. Like, I had convinced myself that, like, I was like super high.
So you gave yourself a marijuana placebo effect.
I gave myself a marijuana placebo. That's not how it works at all, it turns out.
No,
then
it's not.
I started Googling.
But it is kind of like, now. Like, they have, like, the three chief folks, they have that has THC in it. And they're selling it all over Texas now. Like, marijuana is still illegal in Texas. Anywhere you go, like, every two or three blocks here, there's a CBD store. You go in there, they're selling THC shit. Like, they're doing, like, Rice Krispie treats with CBD, but it has THC in it. I don't understand any of that at all.
Yeah, 3Chi has nailed it, pretty much. Whatever they're doing is working. But I didn't know, like, I didn't know quite what CBD was. Well, now those in the Navy will never know. The Navy has banned sailors and Marines from... Oh, us too?
Yeah, I told you.
Oh,
yeah.
I was ripping I was ripping on the Navy in the round. Well, they're still nerds. The Navy has banned sailors and Marines from using shampoos, lotions, soaps that are made with hemp and cannabis oil, one of the main active compounds in cannabis plants. At issue is the possibility that such products could contain too much THC, the actual active psychoactive compound found in pot. And their use could negatively, find a more military statement than this, their use could negatively impact mission readiness and disqualify a sailor from continued service. There's the old mission readiness.
This is the idea of some dumbass master sergeant or senior chief that has nothing else better to do. They see these whippersnappers washing their hair with something that has a marijuana leaf on there, like, not in my Navy, not in my beloved Corps. We're no damn hippies here.
Well, you know what it is? All the people in leadership positions now, I feel like we're coming of age in the 80s when Nancy Reagan was pushing just say no and drugs were bad and this is your brain on drugs. So it's
unbelievable
just been
concept, though. I do not want my brain to be a fried egg.
No,
definitely not. But it's been burned into their skulls.
Yeah, but I think
it's been burned into their skulls of how bad drugs are, so they can't get past any of that, not realizing that CBD has so many natural healing effects, and it can be used for good.
Well, that's why I think Chaps is so right that it was some, like, old fogey walking through the barracks, seeing a CBD leaf on a bottle, like on a hairspray bottle, and being like, "Mother of God,
what are these people doing?
What are they doing?
Have you lost
your
goddamn mind? Piss test for everybody. Take your mask off."
Even if there was a THC shampoo, it really wouldn't do, like, I don't understand.
That's
why
what
CBD...
you brought me here? Phone lockers, foot bags, and shampoo? That's what we're doing?
That's what we're... Shampoos, lotions, and soaps made with hemp, even. Like, come on. Are you serious? Anyways, the Navy banned the use of topical products made with hemp or its derivatives in July, saying it's impossible for consumers to know how much THC is in them. Those labels can be untrustworthy. The policy warns that the use of hemp-based products containing cannabis oil, aka CBD, risks interference with the department's drug testing program. So
Why were you swerving when you came on base?
Well, I took a shower and washed my hair with CBD infused shampoo.
Well, that was me on the first day I had that cut. Would have been me if I had snuck. I was on my way into base and I had my first little CBD coffee. I would have pulled myself over and turned myself in. I fucked up. I'm freaking out, man.
The best part about this story is that, you know, in 10 years, the military's uniform is going to be made completely of hemp. Like, it's going to go from you cannot do this to you must do this. It's going to be just part of the program.
And it's so hard to avoid it now. Most so many health and beauty products contain hemp seed oils and other derivatives. And they say that it hydrates your skin, it heals damaged hair, it battles acne and more without getting you high. Adding to the nerd list, sorry, I guess the Army, Air Force, and Coast Guard already have policies in place that forbid, so we're all nerds. Aww.
Yeah, we're the worst. Anytime something new and good comes about, like spice, yeah, sure, there's a couple of people that jumped out of windows because they were fucking up on spice. That's...
Sure.
And then you all of a sudden, you ban it, like synthetic weed, like just because a couple people wanted to bite folks in the face and rip off their skin?
You rip off one face and everybody gets real butthurt
right.
about it.
You get
it.
Big lesions from trying crocodile one time and all of a sudden
and
you're like a mech.
And everybody freaks out. Right.
Fucking
yeah,
ridiculous.
Okay. Yeah.
But imagine if you were high in Australia doing a little mew goofing and then there's an emu. You don't want to be mew goofing with an emu. I tell you that much right now. That's what we're going to talk about in round number four because emus... they aren't nothing to fuck with. Have you ever had a personal experience with an ostrich or emu?
Yes, I have. And I will tell you this. An emu, by the way, is the second largest bird in the world, second only to an ostrich. And they're all over Australia. I went to the...
ugly as hell, though.
Oh, God,
ugly
yeah.
bird.
I don't ugly bird shame, typically, but I will
I do.
Yeah.
When I was a kid, my aunt took me and my cousin Rachel to some pet convention at some casino.
Of course
and
she did.
There's like a Polaroid of us like holding the boa constrictor and like it like let you be around all these animals that kids shouldn't be around. And then they put us in this pen with fucking emus. It was one of the most horrifying experiences of my life to this day. I won't go, I don't want anything to do with them. Their beaks, they could take a kid's eye out. It was terrifying. They're very aggressive mm-hmm. and pokey and rude.
They just look strung out. Is what they look like.
They're absolute wild cards. And so this story, it's an old story. It's from actually after the First World War. It goes back to, but it was a little bit of Australian military history that I'd never heard of. It's known as the Great Emu War. And actually, when I was down in Virginia Beach for my cousin's retirement ceremony, one of his kids was telling me about it. And so I started looking more into it. And I was like, holy shit, I want to cover this at some point on ZBT. So here we are. But before we get into it, because it's an Australian story, I have a line of, I looked up classic Australian sayings. I don't know what they mean, but I need each of you to give them a go with your best Australian accents. They are labeled for each of you. Chaps, you're up first.
Fair go, mate. Fair suck off the sauce bottle. Fair crack of the whip.
Con.
Few stubby short of a six pack. Few sandwiches short of a picnic.
Okay, me? Better than a ham sandwich. Better than a kick up the big soul.
That was more New Zealand.
That was...
a little Kiwi vibe. A little flight of the Concords, ask Kate.
Better than a ham sandwich. Better than a ham sandwich. Better than a kick up the backside.
You just can't get rid of that. Woo, 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 woo.
Oh, better than a ham sandwich. Better than a kick all the
Kyle's
backside.
Got his.
At least I can't do any worse. Toads, banana benders, cockies, sandgropers, crow eaters.
He did pretty
good.
Yeah,
he did, Kyle.
So we're ready for this. Anywhere you see italics in here, Kyle, we're going to need you to read it in an Australian accent. Okay, so here we go. Let me set the scene. It's after World War One. The Australian government is having a tough time. All these veterans are returning home. You know... like, here in the States, they had all these job programs, all sorts of different things for veterans. So the Australian government was also struggling with that. All these veterans are returning home. How do we find them jobs and places to live and blah, blah, blah. So from 1915, a soldier settlement scheme began to be rolled out across the states in Australia. And eventually, it saw over 5,000 ex-soldiers given plots of land where they could start to do their own farms. So that, like... here, there was neighborhoods built specifically for returning veterans. Like, I think Levittown on Long Island is one of them. So they were kind of doing that there, giving them plots of land, come back and start farming. So by September 1920, the government had purchased over 90,000 hectares for the veterans, but still needed more. And they started to place the remaining soldiers in some pretty marginal areas of Perth and Western Australia. Can you imagine getting back from the war? The government's like, we're going to take care of you, but you're one of the stragglers. And they're like, by the way, you're like... 7 hours out in the bush by yourself behind a giant.
Yeah, it's like
mountain.
Getting a fucking vegetarian omelet MRE. Yeah. You come back late, you know you're just getting screwed.
Exactly. All the good areas have been rat
fucked.
There is
no beef stew left. You're not getting a protein bar.
Right. And so they're getting these areas of preposterous farms with little to no experience in a bad area. So these people, they're like, what? We don't even know how to farm. You're sending me to the middle of fucking nowhere to be alone with my thoughts after the war. Sweet. So anyways, on top of that, the veterans were put under even more pressure when the Great Depression hit. So things are just piling up against them. All right. The government's like, what the fuck do we do? So this person who wrote the story, they said that's some real Australian behavior going on there. And then there was the issue of tens of thousands of West Australian emus that wanted their land back. So they're giving all these Western boonies farms out to these veterans. Meanwhile, it was this land where like tens of thousands of emus had been patrolling. So they're dropping these veterans off in the boonies, and all of a sudden these giant birds are coming.
They come up to the door, and they're like, what is the meaning of this? Why are you here?
Excuse me. So the emus had been a protective native species up until 1922, when they'd made such a nuisance of themselves on the wheat farms, flattening crops, eating them down to a stub, that they were reclassified. They went from endangered directly to listed as vermin. So the country was like, never mind, fuck these guys. They're eating all these veteran farmers' shit. So by late 1932, there were 20,000 emus wreaking havoc on these veterans' wheat farms. And these poor veterans couldn't, like, they're trained riflemen. And they're like, you know what? We're sick of this shit. So they start shooting all these emus. But they could not put a dent in their numbers.
Yeah, because emus now, fuck. They will drop an egg in a heartbeat.
They are just shooting eggs all over the place. They were shooting eggs back at the veterans. Yeah. The lady birds
were
spending over.
Those are big eggs, yeah.
They're like AT-4s pretty much, the eggs coming out of their little, I'll say it, emu vaginas.
Whoa.
Anyways, they started putting bounties out for like how many emu beaks can you bring, whatever. I know certain areas, like certain lakes will have that for invasive species. Like we'll give you X amount for this amount of
Man,
fish that you bring
I would
in or whatever.
Walk, if you put an emu bounty out, I would come walking back into Perth looking like Brad Pitt coming back from World War One when his brother got killed. Just absolute.
Are we just gonna get? Are we just gonna get multiple Legends of the Fall references from here
Maybe.
On out?
Maybe.
Yes,
it's possible.
Well, this is where shit
I don't
gets
hate
crazy.
It. Just ask it.
All these Australian veterans are out in Western Australia. They are struggling and suffering because their farms are getting fucked by these emus. And the veterans now, they're trying to shoot them, they're trying to get the bounties, but there's not enough ammunition. So they called on the Australian military to take action. They sent the army to take out 20,000 giant flightless birds, these emus. And they think, like looking at it historically, it could have been propaganda so that the government could say, look, we're sending in the army to do something to help these poor veterans, these struggling war heroes. So led by Major Meredith of the 7th Heavy Battery of the Royal Australian Army, the army set out on 2nd November 1932. Imagine you're in this unit, and you're like, what are we getting called up for? We're about to go, murder a shit ton of giant birds. Anyways, they moved in formation behind the birds, and the birds answered their organized assault with inspired chaos, scattering themselves in all directions to minimize the casualties. But despite their best efforts, the first blood in the bizarre emu wars was drawn by the Australian army. 2 days later, the emus had their revenge. Concealed gunners sighted 1,000 emus nearby and waited patiently. At point-blank range, the soldiers opened fire, killing maybe 10 to 12, but then the machine guns jammed. They are mowing emus down with fucking machine guns, okay? The emus scattered and had delivered 1,000 of their fluffy hides in their hands to the soldiers before snatching them all back just as quickly. The media had a field day with it, saying,
the emus have proved that they are not so stupid as they are usually considered to be. Each mob has... I'm doing a little heavy British one, aren't I?
No, it's fine.
That's okay.
It's
Keep
all
going.
The same. Australia's a fake country anyways. Each True. Mob has its leader, always an enormous black plume bird standing fully 6 feet high, who keeps watch while his fellows busy themselves with the wheat. At the first suspicious sign, he gives a signal, and dozens of heads stretch up out of the crop. A few birds will always take fright, starting a headlong stampede for the scrub, the leader always remaining until his followers have reached safety.
Do you know what this reminds me of? These emus are essentially velociraptors from Jurassic
yes.
Park.
They do move in herds, clever girls.
Exactly
yes.
right, Kate.
They're not fucking around. The army tried gunning them down and moving trucks, but couldn't aim properly at the speedy foes. They tried all sorts of different ways, like running them over with their vehicles, machine guns, all sorts of shit.
Did they try dropping heavy weights on their heads?
Not yet. They should have watched more Wile E. Coyote. They even had to mount a second campaign, but only killed 40 emus. Months later, they were still trying. Nothing happened.
Imagine going back to the fucking headquarters and being like, how many did you get? 40? 40?
Yeah.
And being like the teacher on Willy Wonka. I can't do just two. about 20?
Well, finally, that Major Meredith, that poor guy who got the officer who got tapped to lead this mission, he did the math. He discovered it took at least 10 bullets to bring down every single emu. That's how,
wow.
That's how raggedy and wild these little fuckers are. that they were like, never mind, and they had to retreat, and they lost.
What's that about?
The great emu war.
10.
They let the emus win.
10 shots to bring down an emu?
Yes, dude. And they're talking about, so it's like,
they need that one recruit from Paris Island. Go out there.
They do. That guy. They need that guy from last week. Sorry if that was a bit of a long story, but I had never heard of it before, and I thought that it was.
Imagine if you're a listener in Australia, and you know for a fact that your grandfather died during the Great Emu War of the early 1930s, and you're sitting there and you're listening to us talk about it, and they're like, "How dare you? Not enough time has gone by in the Emu Wars. You have no idea."
Do they get a ribbon for that?
Oh, yeah.
Do they get a little feather?
And if you, like, for bravery, it's just a beak that's open in the shape of a V.
Yeah, just a little.
I was just thinking, when I start to ramble about Army football and I could see you two just dozing off and not giving a shit, now I know how you feel.
Oh, you're not into Emu Wars?
That was the dumbest story.
No, I disagree. You just wait till I tell King Jesus Kevin about that.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry, guys. I don't have the same emu history as you, so maybe I don't appreciate it as much.
I appreciated it, Kate.
I was so into this little emu story. I didn't know.
Kyle?
I liked it. It was fun.
Okay.
I have been almost attacked twice by big birds. One,
they're terrifying.
Yes. One was at the place called the Serengeti Ranch here in Texas, where you're in there with zebras and antelope, and you have a giraffe named Buddy is in there. And these ostriches and emus that are in there, they are easily the scariest thing. Like, you're in your golf cart going by, and they're fast. A golf cart is not out racing one of these at all. And you have your bag of peanuts, and you're like, oh, shit, here they all come. And they do appear out of nowhere. Like, they're talking to each other. Like, they know what's going on. Scary. And they're three big toes? Get out of here.
They can run faster than Usain Bolt.
Whoa.
The Olympic sprinter. That's 50 kilometers per hour. I don't know how fast that is.
Emus are definitely better athletes than Michael Phelps.
Yeah. Easily. So they can go super fast. They're coming at you. If you look at the pictures, you're like, they're the size of a man.
Uh-huh.
You're like, I get how there's 10,000 of them. 10,000 of them eating these veterans' crops. There's no way that one military unit could have possibly taken them all out. If you loved to shoot, though, this was probably like a dream assignment.
Yeah.
Like, you don't care if you win or lose, really, but you just get to go out there and take these suckers out. Do people eat emu?
Probably. I mean, I would if I was a farmer in Perth. You better believe it. I like to think that there's somebody that's kind of like Clint Eastwood out there that's just gunning down all these emus and has them stacked up. And then whenever he's old, sitting on his porch in Perth, he's talking about, you fucking pussies. You guys don't know what real struggle. You come in here. There's not a big bird in sight.
Exactly.
Have you guys ever had ostrich burger? I have. It's pretty good. I'd imagine emu tastes similar.
Yeah. I have not.
All right, cool. Let's move on to safe rounds and alibis. Kyle, we'll start with you.
Wait.
Oh, what? There's
more. No, we have.
Yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to go into the interview after we're done. So we'll do safe rounds and alibis, and then we're going to go into the interview with Large in just a few minutes. Kyle, what do you got?
Okay, so I kind of want to do for my safe round is like – a preemptive strike against the actually crowd, you know.
Okay.
I'm so tired of them. So nukes, we get it. Maybe it wasn't exactly right. Don't care.
We will never care.
No, don't lecture us on costs and all that shit either. Don't care.
We don't care.
I know Australia is a real country. However, it's a joke. Don't care. That's all I got for this episode.
All right. Love that, Kyle.
Thank you, Kyle.
Cons.
I love it.
Love it, Kyle. Beat Louisiana Monroe. And then also, when you're done listening to Large's interview, there is another podcast in the Barstool Network called Twisted History, hosted by Large. And yesterday, he dropped an interview with his wife, Anne, and she gave her account of the day of 9/11 and what it was like for her to go through that. When you're done with listening to Large, I implore you to go listen to Twisted History and listen to Annie's account. It is moving. It is powerful. I give her so much credit for telling that story because I cannot imagine the feelings that she was going through that day. So I really think it is imperative that you listen to both interviews.
Catherine?
Yeah. Obviously, September 11th here in New York City. And I've done, gosh, you know, I did the Tunnels to Tower run before, where Steven Siller, he was a firefighter, just minding his business, sees it happening in the background and puts on all his gear in Brooklyn and ends up running to the towers, and he lost his life that day. 343 FDMY firefighters were lost that day, and I had the privilege of being at their memorial a couple years ago on the morning of September 11th, where all the families gather and they read all 343 names, and walking amongst the family members and the friends, and it just, the sacrifice and the selflessness of these people just really, you know, 412 emergency workers were killed that day, including a chaplain and two paramedics. And they really, all the people out there who put themselves on the line for us, I'm just really grateful for them. And I know things are going to be a little bit different this year, especially with everything going on with COVID and everything, but there's still going to be ceremonies. If you look online, they're reading all the names that way. And I think VP Mike Pence is expected to be at the ones in New York. President Donald Trump and Joe Biden plan to attend a shorter ceremony at the Flight 93 Memorial in Pennsylvania. And the double beams of light are still going up. But just overall death toll, 2,996 people were killed on that day in all those attacks. And it's just always a somber mood here in New York City, as it should be. And I'm just thinking of everyone affected by it. Over Labor Day weekend, we were out in a boat, and one of the gentlemen on the boat had a bracelet on, and I asked him about it. He said, that's my dad. I was 8 years old, and he was killed in the towers, and so many people around here are still so affected by it. And so just sending so much love, and like the story we're about to hear, everybody has their stories of that day, and I'm just holding everybody close with love. And yeah, it changed, especially to our military listeners, this day changed the course of a lot of our lives in ways we could have never imagined. So just sending a lot of love out there to everyone.
No doubt about it. Here's Large and his story.
So a few months ago, Chaps and I of Zero Blog 30 had the luxury of going on a food tour through Brooklyn with Barstool's one and only Large. And along the way, as we were stuck in traffic, we ended up telling all sorts of different stories. We got to know each other a lot better. I was arrested, now you know that, way back in my early 20s. Lovely drunk in public.
Situation. I was also arrested in seventh grade. I spent the night in the 6-1, the 61st precinct of Coney Island Avenue.
Seventh grade.
It was
started early.
Yeah. I don't mean to brag, but yeah. I was a youth delinquent.
He got me beat. I was like, I had a drunken public at college. And he was like, well, check this out. Seventh grade.
Right.
But we ended up telling all sorts of different stories. And one thing that I was blown away by, I didn't know about you, was that you have a very close connection to September 11th. And we're really grateful that you're here today to share that story with us, because we know that it's definitely a heavy one. And with the anniversary, as the show drops on September 11th, thank you for coming to share your story.
No problem. I started to write a blog last night about it. And it winds up being longer than I thought it was. And it was the first time I actually went down the timeline, because I forgot of what time the first plane hit,
right,
what time the second plane hit. But, you know, where I was in New York City was, I was 10 blocks north of the North Tower in Citigroup's building, because that's where I worked at the time.
Right. Well, yeah, because we always take for granted that everyone knows everyone.
Right.
Prior to joining Barstool, Large had a very illustrious career on Wall Street.
Yeah, so I slept my way to the middle of the finance world. So I had worked 25 years on the street before I decided to do this for some reason. And when 2001, when 9/11 had occurred, I worked for Citigroup. I was a position trader for them on their equity cash desk.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in 390 Greenwich. Is it okay if I got right to it?
Yeah,
let's go.
So I was 10 blocks north. My wife was a broker on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange at the time. So she was 3 blocks south.
Right.
So we were positioned on either side of the towers. My wife, I had met her because I worked for her dad on the floor of the American Stock Exchange. And then I soon began sleeping with the boss's daughter, right? Which is a cute thing to say, but that's
always
what I did.
A good
right.
strategy.
Got arrested in the seventh grade, slept with the boss's daughter when I first got to Wall Street. So anyway,
hope everyone's taking notes.
Yeah, whirlwind romance. So we were, when I worked for her dad, his name is Rick Harvey, he belonged to an eating club at the top of of the North Tower where Winners of the World was. It was called Wild Blue. And Wild Blue was the greatest because they did all these wine tastings and special theme meals. And we used to take customers there quite a bit. And every Tuesday, we had our Tuesday morning breakfast there. Members of the American Stock Exchange, New York Stock Exchange, we'd meet up there and have a great breakfast at the best view of the city in the world. I mean, there was nothing like... Jersey looked great. I mean, like everything was...
Which is sometimes tough to do.
It even made Jersey look good.
Right, right. Yeah. And so nothing but fond memories of Winners of the World, and I was lucky enough to spend every Tuesday morning there. I eventually transferred out. I started working for JP Morgan, a couple of places, and I started working for Citigroup. My wife was still working on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and we were living together in Brooklyn. We were married at the time. And so my wife had a root canal on Monday, and so she didn't go to breakfast on Tuesday. So instead, I drove her to the New York Stock Exchange. I dropped her off. I went north to Citigroup. And, you know, I went to work and I was interviewing somebody, you know, a little bit after 8 o'clock, I think maybe around 8:40-ish and or 8:46. And the first plane hits the North Tower. So it shakes Citigroup's building and they start to evacuate. But I didn't leave. Most of the traders didn't leave, but we were glued to a TV.
And what are your thoughts right at this point when you see one plane hit a tower?
So we see the plane. There's an older gentleman. His name is George Levine. He was our Bloomberg representative. George was an absolute gentleman. He lived for 10 years in the Drake Hotel in Chicago. Like, he was just a classic old school guy. He won a chicken ranch and a bet, like, you know, like that type of stuff.
Right.
And
yeah.
He told me about it. He mailed me a coffin full of, like, air-dried chickens. You know, he's just so he said, oh, somebody fell asleep at the wheel. This is terrible. Right. And then somebody else had said, no, it's a terrorist. And back then, that wasn't your go-to. 2001, we were still a little bit innocent.
Yeah.
So now, you know, an M80 goes off in a schoolyard, and you automatically think sleeper cell. Mm-hmm. But back then, you know, accidents happened. But then not soon afterwards, when people got out, and from our vantage point, since the plane came from the north and hit the North Tower going north, going south, so the hole that it left in the building was a perfect vantage point from 390 Greenwich where we were. So everyone who had hit the streets that was looking up at this, you know, smoldering hole in the building got to see then a plane come from the south and hit the South Tower. And even though it was on the opposite side, that was a big enough explosion. I don't know if people remember this, but the South Tower was the first to fall, even though it was the second to get hit.
Yes.
The North Tower burned for 102 minutes before it fell. So South Tower gets hit, and now everyone knows that we're under attack. So they're now evacuating Citigroup, the building, traders and everything, security. But they can't get me out because I have direct wires to the floor of the New York Stock Exchange from speaking to my wife, who's telling me how she knows her dad's up top and her uncle and all the guys we started in the business with. So her uncle Bob is my best friend and so all these guys. So they're all up top above where the blast went in. And just if you knew, you know, World Trade Center, there were no outside staircases.
Right.
No.
So, and, you know, I'd learned later on that there was like a 15 floor fire that was burning at 2,000 degrees or something I can't get my arms around. So there's no way. But you still were hoping.
Yeah.
And so we decided that we were going to try to meet at the Downtown Athletic Club, and then we'd figure out a plan of attack to get home. So I had left the Citigroup. I started walking south. And when I started walking south, that's when the first tower fell.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the ash and stuff. I ran to the water as we were being, you know, followed by ash. And like a cop in front of me dropped his gun. I swooped down to try and get it, but it slipped. I always wanted a gun.
Yeah.
And I just kept running until we got to the railing. Like, we were all pressed against the railing. And then the ash hit us. And then we all turned around for the first time. And then the Twin Tower had lost its wind. Like, that was the first time we saw a single tower. So then we were pushed back up north. And, you know, I was able to kind of get in touch with her because cell phones were terrible back then. But I called, like, my parents, and she called my parents. So we kind of made a plan, tentative plan, to meet on the other side of either the Brooklyn or the Manhattan Bridge. And, but, like, the tower that her dad was in was still standing. Mm-hmm. And then that one fell.
Yeah.
So and then when the North Tower fell, you know, we knew we were, that everything had gone to shit. So we did wind up... getting to the Brooklyn side, and that's where we eventually met up. I was unable to get my car out of the city. My car was actually in Ground Zero, so I wasn't able to get my car for over a week. And, you know, it was caked in ash by the time I got down there. Like, it's – and, you know, like, as I'm talking about this day, like, I can't help but remember how beautiful that day was. Like,
yeah. It was gorgeous. No. I remember it was my first day of school.
Right.
Senior year of high school. And it was an absolute gorgeous, sunny Tuesday, September day. It was unbelievable.
It, like, you know, like today it's all dreary and whatnot. And I think tomorrow it's supposed to warm up. But like I had sat down like just to catch my breath. And like I looked out. Again, like across at Jersey, so there was no ash going that way because the wind was blowing. I think the wind was blowing east that day. Mm-hmm. So the majority of the smoke was getting pushed towards Brooklyn. So you looked at it. I was like, my God, this is just, you know, it was a great day until it wasn't.
Surreal.
So then we met on the other side and then everything kind of fell apart. Like, you know, we went to the Armory the next day to look. There were seven members of her firm, her dad, her uncle. Pat Dickinson, Tommy Sullivan, Bobby Sutcliffe, Mike Pascuma Jr., Rudy Backus, and then two other guys that used to work for a father who unluckily just took a new job, both of them at Stern AG, so Mike Tamuccio and John Schroeder. They all died. We were at the Armory going through lists of people that they recovered to see if we can come up with anything. And Fox News had heard that there was somebody from the floor there because nobody from the floor of the New York or the American Stock Exchange died because people think like the exchange has something to do with the World Trade Center.
Sure, right. Yeah.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
So the only members of either exchange to die were my father-in-law's company. Mm-hmm. So Fox News asked my wife to come in that night just to, because we're looking for bodies. There were all these rumors that somebody passed out and they were brought to, you know, someplace in New Jersey and they could be alive, or that they were pulling people out of the rubble, which, you know, for the most part wasn't true. You know, like you saw some of the logs that people were putting online of names, and like the logs, some of them said like Elvis Presley, Jim Morrison. So even like people were screwing around that.
Right.
But we were hopeful. So she'd gone to the TV studio, Fox News. And the only thing that she could bring was our wedding album, which we'd married about a year and a half before him. And so she was showing pictures. This is my dad. If you saw him, this is Uncle Bob. If you saw him, this is Pat Dickinson. This is Bobby. Most of the pictures had me in them because it was my wedding.
Right.
So you fast forward a couple months and we start going to memorials and funerals for people within the community. And I'd show up my wife. And everyone who saw me, like, they were like, oh, my God. You know, like, they'd run up to me and they were like, you know, Lodge, we thought you were dead.
We
like,
thought you were gone. Sure.
Because I was part of that thing. So somebody would see Annie and they'd be like, look at Annie. And, like, they didn't realize that I wasn't dead. So, you know, sooner or later, we went to Red Cross and she swabbed and her mom swabbed and they took her mom's DNA out of her. And that was enough for them to be left with her dad's DNA. And they went in and they found a couple of pieces of her father and it was enough for us to cremate. And then we said, we're going to stop with that because it became like a morbid jigsaw puzzle.
Sure.
So it was enough for us. But that wasn't for 9 months. We didn't retrieve any parts of her dad.
Wow.
It sounds terrible to say, but we didn't retrieve any pieces of my father-in-law for 9 months. And then in the interim, because it was the only people on either exchange, they did a huge memorial in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which fits maybe, you know, 2,000 people. But I think there was four. Because it was packed. And my wife was a single person to eulogize all nine men, which is huge.
Wow, that's unbelievable.
So she got up there. I stood behind her crying. Like, I looked like just this giant Asian. Like, I was so swollen and stuff. And so she went up there and she killed it. And then...
And I've had the pleasure of meeting your wife. She's really a very powerful, strong woman.
Yeah.
So it's
she's extraordinary
that she was able to do that.
And then, you know, like, I wrote a story, a blog about a gentleman whose funeral that I attended... a couple of years back, John Mulhern, and like he came out afterwards and helped us with the dissolution of my father-in-law's partnerships. Mm-hmm. Like people had come to our help, but one of the big people that came to our help was this guy Jules, who ran Windows of the World, and he wasn't there that day because he did the dinner thing. And he had known me from when I worked for Rick, so he reached out to me as we were at my father-in-law's house, and we're all like looking through websites and all this stuff to find out where we could get him. And he's like, listen, I see him on the book. I see they haven't left. He's like, I can tell you right now, your father-in-law's and everyone who was up there, like, because they had like almost attendance. Mm-hmm. So he gave us the benefit, a tough phone call to make, but he gave us the benefit of giving up hope. So we no longer were looking for people. We started looking for bodies.
Right.
But, you know, so you fast forward now and 9/11 stinks for us because it's, I mean, I don't know how it would be like if my father died in a car crash and they showed that car crash on TV continuously once a year, you know? But, you know, like my son has read the names down in Ground Zero You know, we've had some positives as far as that goes. That museum down there is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for a, yeah. you know, and I know people are affected a lot more than my family and I, but that museum is wonderful. If you're ever on Thames Street in between Greenwich Place and Greenwich Street and Trinity, that's now Emmerich Harvey Place. It's mm-hmm. named after my father-in-law. Like, you
oh,
know,
wow.
and that's on the corner of the American Stock Exchange where he spent, you know, 40 years of his life.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, we cope and stuff, but this is one of those weeks, like, I won't be in the office tomorrow.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I know having it be a national holiday is not realistic. You know, this time of year, you know, Jewish holiday, Labor Day and all that stuff, you can't, like, squeeze something in.
Mm.
But it is for us. You know, mm. like, we'll...
Yeah.
We'll probably send the kids to school, and then we'll just kind of lay around and kind of turn off all the TVs and stuff like that.
So let yeah. me ask you then, what do you think the response should be, or how do you react to how everyone now treats 9/11 17 years later? Because I think everyone still honors everyone's memory, but we're 17 years removed from it. It's not as the wound isn't as fresh as it was in 2002, 3, 4. So what is your reaction to that?
Well, I think
obviously yours being a lot different than the rest of
mm-hmm.
right. The country. So I mean, I think when you're in New York, there's still a proper a respect towards it. It's gotten less and less. I mean, there's never been an 9/11 sale at Old Navy, 2-for-1 capris. Like
right.
they've never done anything like that. Which, you know, for people sometimes might frown on that for Memorial Day or you know some. So they don't do anything disrespectful, but I do see that every year a little less coverage comes. Like I think yeah. last year was the first year that it didn't make the front page on 9/11, and it wasn't like it wasn't something that was that big, you know, like it was, yeah. you know, not Kim K gets a surgery or anything like that,
right.
but there was something else where 9/11 was like the second page. In New York, that's not acceptable.
Do you think it's right. a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a bad thing. Like, I think as much as I say that my wife needs to go into hiding for that day just to keep her sanity, I think the whole never forget, I think the whole never forget credo is probably true, right? Because if we, listen, nobody is going to let this happen again, mm-hmm. right? Although there's a good chance that it does because of all the stuff. And mm-hmm. that's why having Rob O'Neill on last week mm-hmm. on my radio show was so, by the way, it's my radio show now, apparently. But no, but having her on Barstool Breakfast was so huge for me. And then having my wife meet him at
yeah.
a charity function the week before, she molested him.
Yeah.
I mean, she straight up, he was defenseless and he's
yeah,
a trained
right.
killer. Like
yeah,
she
yeah.
could, and you know,
means a lot.
But yeah, like I don't need it to be, I like to avoid it, but I see less and less of it. So this whole new generation of kids, like these kids who are the interns this year, if it was 17 years ago, these kids were five.
No concept
yeah.
of it really.
And if they're coming from Youngstown, Ohio or something like that,
sure.
they really don't know. And I don't know like Pearl Harbor, how long that took before it sort of faded into Bolivia. But I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know what the timeline is with 9/11, but it's an especially, you know, sore wound for me.
Yeah.
So I don't yeah. mind. I'll avoid it, but like my kids will always know about it. Like
sure.
they'll have the benefit and, you know, they've rang the bell on the New York Stock Exchange on 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
They, like
yeah.
I said, they did the names. And when my son did the names, he was only 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they gave him some doozies. Like they really didn't plan for it. Like not a lot
they
of
They knew he
Mets.
Was advanced.
Yeah.
They
yeah,
said,
so
this kid's got it.
But I think
yeah.
I agree with you. I think in New York, it'll always obviously be.
I love the Towers of Light.
Oh, it's so gorgeous.
Yeah.
Right.
I get chills
so
when
powerful.
I see it.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, just each year, and even hearing you now tell this story, it'll always, I think, give me chills. And it'll
right.
still always move me just because of the profound impact it then had on my life from that day forward.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to what you said about becoming friendly with Rob O'Neill, do you think that has helped with you and your wife at all?
Having, yeah.
you know, kind of maybe brought it full circle?
Right. Like, I really thought that it might not be the healthiest thing in the world for her,
mm-hmm.
but it was, I hate to give it such a juvenile thing as like a bucket list,
because yeah,
it's
right.
not, but she, you know, like when you think about Japanese culture, the idea of avenging your father's death or your father-in-law's death mm-hmm. is like, you know, not that I've all of a sudden turned into a Ronin overnight,
mm-hmm.
but like Rob O'Neill is the guy who killed the guy
yeah.
who killed my father-in-law. And so when my wife met him, I mean, she was absolutely overcome. And she's like, I said, okay, we're going to try to get out to dinner with his wife and stuff. And she's like, believe me, just getting me to meet him was enough. It really was like something where she checked the box emotionally, more so than me checking a box when I finished a 64-ounce steak or something like that. Like she really, she really did check a box emotionally. So, and I think Rob understands that. Like, I think he's had a lot of people in that situation. Mm-hmm. So he intimated something to her from that night, like sort of whispered in her ear. And maybe it's common knowledge, maybe it's not, but it gave her the impression that, you know, she was on the inside a little bit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, because, you know, you talk about overwhelming hatred. We never like to blame many for the actions of few. So we were never the type to just write off the whole Middle East. But when we heard news that there were people dancing in the streets in Brooklyn, like some, and, you know, Arab cultures and stuff like
Patterson,
that.
In New Jersey. Yeah, that was, you know, like that was tough.
It made us angry, and it makes you a little bit racist, and it makes you a little bit stupid. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that I'm glad to say that that's, you know, been tempered. I still won't eat halal on 9/11. I won't eat sushi on December 7th. Like, you know what I mean? Like that whole thing, because I'm an idiot. But, you know, there is no far reaching thing. But what we did hate was this one guy.
Yeah.
So then to have him get three put in his head, you know, to where they had to piece his head back together, take a picture.
Yeah. Not mad about that.
No, and it meant everything.
Not too upset about that one.
For my wife to meet him.
Yeah.
You know, so. So it was that was a win-win for me.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah. On my radio show.
I just went down there this past weekend, and I've been through the museum three times now, and every single time it absolutely blows me away. Like you said, they did such a great job with it. I think they did a really beautiful job, especially considering, too, like so much input and so much feeling and emotion that had to be a difficult thing to, you want to get it so right. But I think they did a good job, and walking around there always just kind of takes your breath away when you look at the scale of it. The one thing that I love is the survivor tree down there.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
I haven't been there. I want to go.
I've only been once.
Yeah, I would love to go.
I was there 6 months ago because we had friends in from California, and they were like, we want to go down. Mm-hmm. I was like, I don't know if I went to California if the first thing I'd want to see is something like, you know, like, take me to the Irish Famine Museum. Like, I would never want to have that kind of bring down. I want to go to, you know, best chili dog in town or something.
Yeah.
Like that. But we did go down there. So that was the second time my wife had gone down, the first time I had gone down. And because we had a family member who passed away, I don't know if you know this, we had a VIP thing. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge line. It's a very big tourist attraction.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We go right through and you get like a white glove treatment, which is wonderful, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's very nice for like somebody who had a situation where they feel like they're more entitled to walk through a memorial than everybody else, than somebody wearing an I Love New York t-shirt. Mm-hmm. And they give the families that.
That's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I mean, it really is such a beautiful memorial.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your reaction to what they did down there?
With
the memorial and everything.
So, yeah. So I have the whole area. I have, you know, kind of a problem. So I love the Tower of Light, Towers of Light.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I love the memorial.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like Freedom Tower. I don't think it fits. Like, I don't think it fits Lower Manhattan. I think it should be in, like, you know, I don't know, like an Arab Emirates type thing, like one of those more silky type buildings.
Yep.
I don't know why they didn't put up two towers. Like, I don't know why the Twin Towers got knocked down. They put up the Freedom Tower, and it took them so many years to build. You know, like, I think that American ingenuity and, like, our stick-it-to-em-ness, if that's a word or it is now, should have had them make one tower 9 feet taller, one tower 11 foot taller, and they just look like two big middle fingers pointing right at the Middle East. Like, I thought that that would be the most fitting thing. Like, you know, go ahead, send them over again. We'll throw them up even higher. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? And I didn't mean to be like juvenile and say, well, cover them in pork or anything like that. But I wanted that to happen.
Yeah.
And then when this thing happened.
Yeah. I'm with you. I don't really like the way it looks. I mean, it's a nice attempt at a symbol to say that, hey, you can knock us down, but we're going to come right back up.
Right.
But at the same time, I would agree with your sentiment that it's not, I don't think it's the best way they could have done that.
And cons, I grew up across the river in Brooklyn, as you know, from our food tour.
I do. Yeah?
And by the way, it was a very detailed food tour. I think we got into the whole thing. So so Kate and Chaps had gotten intimate because cons wasn't invited to like exactly where I was. So I stared across, and I went to high school in Lower East Side. Like, I stared across Manhattan, and I looked at those goddamn buildings.
Right.
And I didn't wonder at them every day.
Mm-hmm.
But with them not there now, it's crazy.
Yeah,
it's very crazy. Weird. It's always eerie too, and you see them in old TV shows and old movies.
Old movies.
And you're like,
yeah.
Oh my god!
Right.
So for 30 years to see them, and then for the last 17 not, and instead now seeing this thing. I just don't think it fit. It's not the skyline, like the way that the skyline used to be. Mm-hmm. And even the newer stuff that goes up that I think kind of, you know, doesn't belong in the skyline because I'm an old man. But like the way the skyline used to be, to have that anchor, like those two towers as an anchor, and now not like now to have that other thing. Still just bothers me. And it doesn't bother me that FiDi is built up so much and all the millennials live there, or not like not even the millennials, but like the people in the financial industry who just started. They all have apartments
right
back
there.
Where I traded.
Yeah.
And, you know, that whole, I mean, there are people who've sold houses when they found out it was on an Indian burial ground. I mean, they are on top of the detritus of thousands of dead bodies. So, like, I never really felt strongly about that. Like, I guess that's fine. But the tower itself, the Freedom Tower itself, bugs me.
What do you think about this statue? I think it's such a cool statue. The horse soldier memorial statue. Have you seen that?
No, I don't
there?
Know. No.
It's a statue that memorializes our special operations soldiers who were the first ones to go into Afghanistan October of 2001, right after 9/11. And they actually there was a book written, 12 Strong. The movie was made, 12 Strong, where these guys went in on horseback. Yeah. Really primitive, just because that was the only way that they could get to the enemy. So my question to you, though, is what do you think about the military in general and our response since 9/11? Because I don't think you have much military in your family, being the son of immigrants.
None.
Right. So, right. I mean, what was your feeling about the military prior to and then post 9/11?
So I've always had an overwhelming respect for the military. When my dad came over here, he was 19, came over from Ireland, and but my mom came over when she was much younger. She was 12 or 13. So she actually grew up 12, 13 on. And then her brother wound up going to Vietnam and doing a bunch of tours and became a sniper, Marine sniper. And then when he came back, he was damaged goods, right? So he went down the wrong path with drug addiction and stuff like that, and eventually led to his death. So I've always had that thing, like, I'm not letting my kids go down that path, just because the only person in my family who did it, and we still have the picture of him with his handsome, you know, the white hat and stuff like that, but we know what happened to him. And then you fast forward, and my wife has a cousin who had graduated, and he was the first graduating class that was sent right overseas. So I don't know what year it was, but when we were up for a game, like, people were saying, oh, I'm class of this, and he said, oh, I'm class of this, maybe 2002.
Yeah.
And everyone went up right away. All the other Army guys, all the other West Point guys were like, oh, thank you for your service. Like, they knew he was the first class out.
Right.
And he came back damaged goods, eventually found CrossFit and found the right woman and found like this.
Right.
And so he's totally 100%. But I've only had that history of seeing people get ruined by the military.
Sure.
So I've always told my kids, I guess I'll break your leg or, you know, like that. Like that. And I'm also a natural coward. So I wouldn't, who's never been able to do a chin up. So I knew that I wasn't military grade. My brothers are much tougher than me, so they could have. So I've had this like tertiary relationship to the military, but I've become such a patriot since 9/11, and all my friends that are anywhere near the military, two of my roommates at school were ROTC, Air Force ROTC, Air Force, whatever. And they went, you know, and one of them is a lifer there now. And so we get like little tidbits from him and stuff like that. We're an extremely patriotic family. I mean, for a first generation Irish American family, and my wife is very conservative. She's very Republican. Mm-hmm. And she is a huge, like, military. So my kids, you know, like, we're extremely respectful with the whole deal. And I wasn't necessarily, I was more selfish.
Sure.
I didn't care. I mean, I love, you know, military movies, but that was it. I didn't have a love for the military that I do now since that time. So as far as what we should be doing, if we should still be over there or whatever that is, you know, it's above my pay grade, which is a military kind of thing. But my family, as one of the better results of it, have become a big military lovers. It's the only reason I hang out with you guys. I feel like I always
spent a lot of money on our Brooklyn food tour on oysters and stuff, and only to hear me be like, I don't eat oysters.
Oh,
but you can't be mad at me because I was in the military.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's an unwritten rule.
That trump card.
Yeah.
But,
so if you could leave everyone that's listening with one thought for 9/11 that they should take with them each year when 9/11 comes, what would that thought be?
Well, you know, like, so on 9/10/2001, right? You know, my wife and I had zero cares in the world. And we're married 20 years. We have three beautifully expensive kids. But, you know, like, all of a sudden on, you know, So on 9/10, and then on 9/12, when we moved on after 9/11, like, we still realize that every time my son just started playing high school football Saturday, and his grandfather would have loved that.
Right.
So, you know, like, it, without getting too sappy, like, you really don't know what you have, right, until it's taken away. Mm-hmm. And it gets taken away in the fucking blink of an eye. Right.
Yeah.
So, like, as a result, we've circled the wagons as a family. We've become, like, our core five. Nobody else gets to screw with us. Like, it's made us stronger, mm-hmm. which, you know, and we think about stuff. You know, and plus the friends that we lost too, like outside of the family, because I'm, you know, I'm a New Yorker.
Right. From, yeah. Right.
So it's like they didn't even give it, I didn't even have time to like, to, I don't know, to like remember that they had died. There were so many funerals.
Yeah.
So I think we now so take a, you know, we just take a list of everything that's special to us, and we're more thankful for it because we know that, you know, it's going to be 9/12 again, you know, someday, you know, and right. something, it's going to be 12/23 one day. And it's going to be after the 12/22 bombing or something like that. And there's those bombings, which used to be once in a lifetime now, are twice a year. So, you know, it's made us a little bit thankful and stuff like that. So kind of look around, like even like your parents, and think about what it would be like if they just happened to be enjoying a beautiful breakfast and windows of the world when some, you know, clumsy fucking asshole decided to drive a plane through it.
Yeah.
So, I have. I've taken stock in my life since then, and I encourage people to do the same.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing that story.
A little bit heavy, right?
Really, really appreciate it. And I think I owe you a Brooklyn food tour now after this. Yeah, I think I definitely, maybe some martinis in there. But thank you, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for the invite.
Thanks, Large. And I'm coming on the next tour.
Yeah.
The next food tour.
Yeah, just invited yourself.
Squirrel on my way in there. I don't give a shit. I'm coming.
Yeah. All right.